Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening, hot stuff?
Fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
The voice of a generation has died. John Hughes passed away this past Thursday, August 7th, at the much too young age of 59. And the brilliant credits of this legendary writer, producer, and director included The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pretty in Pink, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Mr. Mom, the National Lampoon Vacation films, and the Home Alone films, just to name a few. Movies that were just such a major part of so many people's lives. And tonight on Movie Geeks United, we will explore the legacy Mr. Hughes leaves us, movies that continue to resonate with both the youth and adults of today, with several of his creative collaborators who helped him shape cinematic history along the way. My name is Jamie,
and yeah, I have Jerry. There I am. I'm on the air. I didn't know because, you know, we were having difficulties earlier.
Yeah, we had a few technical difficulties to start out the show, but we're okay now. Jerry, I wanted to start out by asking you, what movies of John Hughes do you continue to go back to?
Well, I went back and watched Breakfast Club and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but ironically, the one that I really like a lot is Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yeah.
I keep going back to that every couple of years because I just think that film is perfect. It's not, and it's not diminishing anything that he did before or after, because I think, you know, what's very interesting about him is I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about another director. But it's like I was alive for all of his films. I watched him from the very beginning to, you know, the very end. All of his, yeah. I didn't need to go back and watch anything. I watched Class Reunion that he wrote for National Lampoon
sure.
in the theater. I watched the Vacation films. I watched the Delta House series that was based on Animal House that he wrote in the,
yeah.
I think it was 79 or 80. So he took all the great things of that kind of subversive humor, and then brought it into these teenage films, and he spoke to us. He never talked down to his audience, which is so important because I see it in films today.
Yeah.
Where they talk down. He never talked down to us, and that is the most important thing. He never condescended. He treated us like we were human beings, and that was so wonderful.
And that's a theme that we'll be hearing time and time again throughout tonight's broadcast. We have a great show tonight with a great assortment of tremendous talents, and let's get it started with our first guest. Our first guest tonight played the title role in Curly Sue, which was the last film that John Hughes directed in 1991, and since that time she's become a highly accomplished theatrical performer, dancer, and musician, and we are pleased to welcome her to the show tonight to share her remembrances of John Hughes, Miss Allison Porter. Miss Porter, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am.
Thank
Welcome.
You so much for calling in and joining in on this. Thank you.
Of course. My pleasure.
Tell me how you heard the news about his passing, and what were the thoughts that were going through your mind when you did hear?
I got a phone call from a couple friends and a few text messages, you know, saying to, you know, check the website, that kind of thing. And then actually one of the assistant ADs from Curly Sue gave me a call. And I heard his message that he left me. So that's basically how I found out.
And what were the thoughts that you had when you heard?
Well, obviously really shocking and, you know, just sad. You know, he was so young and, you know, such a big part of my life. So it was definitely quite a shock you know, to say the least, and definitely very unexpected.
Well, let's talk about that big part of your life. You were 9 or 10 when the Curly Sue opportunity came about, right?
Yeah.
How did it come about?
You know, very prepared for it. My mom curled my hair and put a baseball hat on me and got me, you know, into care.
Allison, I think your phone is breaking up pretty badly. I don't know if it's bad cell reception. It might be.
Is it? Hold on. Let me try to move here.
Okay. You sounded better there. Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
Is that better?
That's much better.
Okay. Well, you know, as I was saying, sorry to be breaking up. It was just a your normal average audition, and you know, just became something that was a lot bigger than most of the auditions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And how did he direct you? How did he handle you on set? Okay, I think we've lost Allison. Her phone line isn't functioning.
Okay.
Very well.
No, but it's very interesting because she had, I would imagine, working with Kelly Lynch and James Belushi at the time, especially those two, that's got to be an incredible experience to be able to work with those two actors in your first film and your first big film, and it's just incredible to work with those two because, I mean, Kelly Lynch, Drugstore Cowboy, Roadhouse, and James Belushi, I mean, he needs no introduction, and John Hughes. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just an incredible experience. I don't care who you are. That's a great, great set to be on.
Well, let me say if she can hear us. Her line just disconnected. If she can call back from a landline, we'll be happy to bring her back on.
Absolutely.
But you were saying, Jerry, that Some Kind of Wonderful is one that you keep going back to. The two that I'm most addicted to are Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I mean, watched that again last night, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stop laughing.
It's hysterical.
I couldn't stop laughing. And I think something needs to be said about John Hughes and his relationship with John Candy, because after that was on, Stripes was on AMC, and of course butchered by AMC. But he really was the only other director besides Ron Howard and Ivan Reitman to really give John Candy the benefit of the doubt, to take advantage of all his great comedic talents, and not so much because he was a big guy or whatever, but he wrote real three-dimensional parts for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important to really bring that up because those movies, I mean, the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is so wonderful, and Uncle Buck is wonderful, and Only the Lonely, I mean, these were all these great movies he did before his untimely death. And just incredible. And Ferris Bueller, I mean, God, we'll talk about the coolest teenager since James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause.
I so wanted to be Ferris Bueller after I saw that film.
Oh, who didn't?
Okay, let's see if we can bring Allison back on. And then we have another phone call from one of Mr. Hughes' collaborators. Allison, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
I can hear you. Yes.
Okay, wonderful.
You were starting off. You told me that about the audition or the opportunity that came up for Curly Sue, and you're about to tell me what your impressions of John Hughes was when he directed you. How did he direct you?
You know, honestly, it was like working with like your favorite uncle or your dad or you know your best friend. He really like tailor made the part, you know, for me, and he would ask me, you know, what I wanted, and I was 9 years old, you know, but it really became, you know, just an extension of me as a human being. You know, the character was very much, you know, a part of me, and I remember, you know, he found out I could sing, and so that's why he put in the national anthem scene, and then, mm-hmm. you know, there were a lot of instances like that where, you know, he took things, you know, from me as, you know, who I was and just sort of manipulated it into the movie.
Yeah.
And he was always very, very kind and very, you know, very committed to, like, knowing me and being a part of
Did you tell me what you learned from him when you look back on that time? What were the lessons that you took from him? Okay, her line is out. I'm sorry, we can't get a good connection on her phone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's that was Allison Porter. Hopefully we'll have an opportunity to speak to her again, but her connection isn't very good. We can't hear anything. So let's go back to the beginning of his career. He was an advertising man.
He was a advertising copywriter. He's the very definition in the film business and even in advertising of self-made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to bring that up especially about the advertising, because a lot of people, it's usually the other way around sometimes. People who try to go into the film business, they can't break in, or they have problems and they go into advertising. He went into advertising and then he broke into the film business, and the way he did it was just beautiful. I mean, and he wrote jokes for people. He wrote for National Lampoon, which is one of the most important, I still think one of the most important, but one of the most important comedy venues, publications of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. And he knew that was his strength, was as a writer.
Yes.
And he felt kind of suffocated in the advertising industry, and he really wanted to break out and be a writer for film and eventually direct. And
right.
He took a chance because he didn't want to live with the regret if he didn't.
Right.
And he was very successful almost right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. He was.
Even though I wrote, because he wrote Mr. Mom and Vacation. And I didn't, I was listening to an interview he did in 1985. I think it was an AFI event that he interviewed for. And he was saying he was smack dab in the middle of shooting 16 Candles when Mr. Mom, I think, in Vacation broke. And he was so much in a bubble, he wasn't even aware that he had the success that he had at that stage already.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
and
that's both of those films, that's quite a double whammy. I mean, those are great. I mean, of that year, of that time period, I remember seeing those. I mean, I saw Vacation in the theater. I saw Mr. Mom on video. But those are just really two wonderful films of that time period.
I remember Mr. Mom. Mr. Mom was a big movie for me when I was little. I loved it. And that's obviously.
I couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah, that's obviously the first time that we fell in love with Michael Keaton, that Night Shift. But
yeah,
he really, really came to power in Mr. Mom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, especially when
he showcased the best of
dropping the kids off at the school. You're doing it wrong. That's one of the great. I love that part. You're doing it wrong, Dad.
That is the thing about John Hughes, his dialogue. If you think back of the great quotables in film from the past 20 plus years,
he's at the top of the list.
He is, yeah. And you don't realize it until I've been reviewing clips and movies of his all weekend, and just the enormity of his influence in terms of the slang and the dialogue that's permeated the culture since.
Mm-hmm.
The music is another big legacy he had, and of course the casting of talent, the discovery of new talent.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this thing, Simple Minds. I'll always associate Simple Minds, that song, with Breakfast Club. There are certain songs, the Psychedelic Furs with Pretty in Pink. I mean, he got it right.
Yes.
He got it right. That's all I can say. He just knew.
We have another one of his collaborators on the phone, a longtime collaborator of Mr. Hughes. I hope this is his line. I believe it is. This is composer Mr. Ira Newborn. Mr.
Oh,
Newborn, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in, sir.
No problem.
Now, you tell me about the first time that you met John Hughes.
Well, I had just finished doing a movie called Into the Night.
Yes.
With Michelle Pfeiffer and Jeff Goldblum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was the producer. Could it be? No. Joel Silver, who's a well-known producer. He is a friend of mine from like around 1975.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you have to meet this guy. And he dragged me over onto the set. And we talked in the middle of shooting.
And what was the connection between the two of you? Because you guys collaborated on many projects, very, very successful projects. What clicked between the two of you?
Well, he was an interesting character. He was sort of an adult kid, which
mm-hmm.
I completely approve of, because I'm like that too. I mean, I think, when you get old and your bones start creaking, but your spirit and enthusiasm shouldn't start creaking.
Right.
And he was like that. And I think we were both gleeful, I guess you could put it that way.
Yeah.
We were gleeful about clever jokes and funny things and music that really hit and just, yeah.
Well, it's obvious watching his movies that he kept that child inside of him, or that teenager inside of him. What was the collaboration like in these films, like 16 Candles and Weird Science and Planes, Trains? How did you guys work together? Did he work closely with you?
Both, on and off. In 16 Candles, we were talking a lot because, I mean, I could see it was a guy who was enthusiastic about what he was doing and really loved music, and
mm-hmm.
that made me happy, so I was happy to talk to him. Very often, a composer doesn't want to talk to the director because the director doesn't know anything about music.
Right.
And so it's sheer torture trying to translate and pretend you know what he's talking about, and that even though you think he's a big schmuck, you don't say that. With him, as far as music is concerned, he was tremendously enthusiastic. I remember we went, he said, hey, let's go to the record store. And we went to Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard, and he must have bought $1,000 worth of records. They needed a
wow.
truck to take them home.
I love that record store.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know if it's still there. I think they closed it. But
oh, they did? Oh.
But we bought a ton of stuff, and he actually listened to all of it. And then he'd give me tapes of really interesting stuff that I never would have heard and never would have thought about, from England and, you know, all kinds of groups that were just under the radar that he thought he could pop into notoriety.
Yeah. And more often than not, he did.
Yeah, but I'm telling
you,
I've got to tell you, he had really special taste in music. He definitely turned me on to a whole bunch of music that I never would have listened to.
Mm-hmm. What fascinates me about film composition, we speak to many composers on the show, and I would think that composing the comedy film, which you've done quite a bit of, would be a special challenge.
It is. It's bloody murder.
Did
you ever hear about that? I don't know who it was. It wasn't Sir John Gielgud, but a famous British actor was in bed dying, and a couple other famous guys like Sir Ralph Richards or John Gielgud was sitting by his bedside, and he would be talking, and he'd lapse into unconsciousness, and then he would come back, and these guys in between would be looking at him with pity. And finally, one of them said to the other one, when he was in one of these periods of being unconscious, he said, oh, dying is so hard. And he opened his eyes and said, no, comedy is hard. Dying is easy.
Right, right.
And it's the truth. So, let's put it this way. Comedy, music, writing has come a while away from the time you see cartoons in
mm-hmm.
the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
In the old days, you could deliberately play the physical action. That's called Mickey Mousing, because
sure.
that's what they did in Mickey Mouse movies. But as the humor get more serious, or if you pardon the expression, more subtle, there's a lot of different ways to play it. You
mm-hmm.
can imply things. If you have a good sense of humor, you can see aspects of the joke that are not obvious and enhance them. So it is bloody murder, especially if you care about what you're doing. I'm certainly more than a humorous guy, but I used to sit there doing it as seriously as I could, And I would be watching these things over and over and over, trying to get what was happening and how to make it just right and subtle and not too obnoxious unless it called for that. And, yeah, it's definitely difficult.
It's a
and
tough
it's
challenge,
I was
yeah.
at it, I had to keep struggling each time.
Well, I think this correlates with the talent, one of the many talents that John Hughes had, because his movies were very funny. But they were never less than human and relatable.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't easy, you know.
I have to agree with that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have to agree with that. I agree.
When you did so many films with him? What were the experiences that stood out for you?
Maybe Ferris Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he had hired... being kind of a kid and being very enthusiastic and not really understanding the professional world of
mm-hmm.
movie making,
mm-hmm.
he thought he could do anything. So he didn't know how much time it took to do something and how long it would take someone he hired to do something. So apparently he got this fabulous idea to hire what amounted to a DJ. Well, he got a DJ to do the music for Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And, I thought he liked what I did on 16 Candles. Well, what the heck. So anyway... She hired this guy, and then all of a sudden, after like a couple of weeks and probably using up most of the budget, I get a call from the editor, the film editor, Paul Hirsch, who is a great editor
yes.
and a great
yeah.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's really talented. He calls me up and says, Ira, could you come down and rescue us? I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, this music sounds like, you know, the dog died, and this one sounds like... So... I said, okay. And I went down, and they showed me the movie with this music. And I remember thinking, oh, man. And I walked up to John, and I made my finger like a gun and put it between his eyes. And he said, yep.
Wow.
So, but then it was only 20. I had 2 weeks to write it. That was memorable. And like, here it is. I'm going to rescue this film, which, you know, seemed good. And I had to kill myself for 2 weeks trying to figure out what was going on, what to do, and how to write it. But luckily, it came out good.
Oh, it came out more than good.
Oh, it came out perfectly.
That's one of the great
films. You know what else reminded me of it? The other thing that was humorous?
What's that?
He has this tune in the movie, Oh Yeah, by Yellow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is the most famous piece I never wrote. Someone said, oh, you did Ferris Bueller? Oh, I love that. Oh, yeah. I didn't write.
You should take credit for it. Go ahead.
No way. So anyway, so I have to do a session to make up music for like when Shauna, his sister, you know, is looking at Emilio Estevez, and they mm-hmm. start this doo-wop music behind there and doo-wop music for Ducky or whatever the heck his name was in the car with the prom queen.
Right.
And so the next movie, sorry, that's 16 Candles, but on Ferris Bueller, so I'm in the studio trying to record this doo-wop music, vocal music. Next thing I know, the bass singer is suing me and Paramount Pictures because we stole his voice. He says I recorded him saying, oh, yeah. And then I stuck it in this music without telling him.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Oh. So I'm thinking,
they went after you for that?
Well, he filed a lawsuit saying I stole his voice, saying, oh, yeah. And I told him, this record is 2 years old.
They could have gone, well, wait, I mean, really, you know, to be very honest with him, probably the Kool-Aid guy could have gone after him for that, but I mean,
so
okay.
Could the guy that was in Singers Unlimited and originally sang the Ajax jingle in 1955. He had a
yeah.
low voice, too.
Yeah.
But what's ridiculous is anybody who knew anything about anything could listen to that and could tell that's not a natural human voice. It's a
exactly.
voice
yeah.
pitched down.
Now, you actually, if I'm not mistaken, and I very well could be because I often am, your last collaboration, yes, your last collaboration with John Hughes, was it Uncle Buck?
Uncle Buck.
Yeah, and did you keep in touch with him through the years after?
Well, let's put it this way. I admired John Hughes' talent, and I admired his intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And numerous things. I mean, I definitely admired it. I thought he was really talented and very smart. There were certain aspects of life that he and I disagreed on.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
And I am much less likely to cut someone off or not talk to them because of these disagreements. Other people are not as open, shall we say, as I am to talking with people who have big differences with them involving
right.
life choices and behavior.
Well, the important thing for us as movie fans is that you guys got on like a wildfire for these films.
Your collaborations with him are classic.
The real truth is, other than certain things, I had a big kick working with him because he was really smart and really talented, and I really admired that. And he wasn't just some, like, regular schmo. He was
yeah.
really smart and really talented, and it was really a pleasure. I mean, that much is a great pleasure. Someone who was
yeah.
constantly trying for new stuff and didn't keep, you know, pulling up the same old garbage. He was always looking for stuff. He could write faster than anybody
right.
you ever saw.
Oh. Yeah.
And like I said, he was like a kid. He was constantly joking around, and this is very attractive to me because I
right.
think that's what you should be when you're alive.
Absolutely. Mr. Newborn, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and
yeah.
we both welcome you back on anytime in the future to talk about the remainder of your career. We'd love
yeah.
to hear about
the remainder,
it.
But I would be remiss, though, if I didn't say all the work that you did with Mr. Hughes is just classic, but also the theme to the Naked Gun movies. We could not leave without saying that. That's just beautiful stuff, all of it.
I appreciate it. Well, I love music and I love movies. What can I say?
Well, you're at the right place.
And we love your work. So please come back to us in the future, sir. Thank you.
I will. Thanks.
Thank
Take
you, sir.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
That's Ira Newborn, a longtime composer for Mr. John Hughes. And we have a call, 917 area code. 917?
Yes, hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I was just calling in to just add in to your show on John Hughes.
Please.
Please, go for it.
Oh, I totally, totally loved his work. I was growing up in the 80s and saw 16 Candles, which is my favorite of his films.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was just 16 Candles, Weird Science, Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink. They all had a wonderful energy to them, a wonderful zaniness and originality and a freshness. And John Hughes just really... you know, even as a kid being in high school, you just kind of figure, wow, the person who wrote this story really tapped into what teenagers were.
Yes.
You know,
you felt
yeah.
like he was there. He was spying on us almost, like he was in your class with you. He was in gym class. He was at the lunchroom almost.
And
or
let me
in your skin or something.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, too, that he had a special way of writing female characters in that age group, too. I mean, Molly Ringwald really was... a great hero to many teenage girls at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Oh, absolutely. And just adds on to another point that I wanted to bring up is I love how it's funny because I think my father at the time was telling me, he's the one who probably pointed this out, but all of the heroes of his stories, Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, Weird Science, they're kind of the unpopular people. They're kind of the people who are on the outside, and they ended up...
That's right.
You know, he was kind of speaking for the people in high school who had glasses and braces and all different types of things. So I think, he was able to really tap into all of the quirks, and not only just not only just the unpopular or the so-called people not in the A crowd in high school, but just he was able, you know, with the Breakfast Club, of course, he was able to bring in the jock and the the rebel, so to speak, and you know, just the prissy girl, and then the sort of quirky girl. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I just really, I'm so glad you guys put together this show. And
well, thank you, and thank you for calling in. I think what's great about The Breakfast Club, I watched it again the other night, I watch it every couple of years, is that he was able, I think with that film more than anything else, and I think some of, you know, when we were growing up in the 80s in high school, a lot of, some of the popular kids lost track of what the film was about, but he basically, we're all outcasts at the time. It really doesn't matter who you are, what social caste you're in. Everyone is an outcast.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because I think he would classify himself as one of those guys that were kind of less than popular. But two things come out in some of these conversations that we're going to play in a little bit with his collaborators. He could start out with types, like he did in Breakfast Club. And as you got to know them throughout the film, they transcended types. And also it's surprising to find that a lot of times the popular people that he depicted in these teen movies, they have the same insecurities, the same issues as the unpopular.
Right.
There was kind of a universal understanding, a very authentic voice he had in all of these films. And, of course, I'm having computer issues, so I'm trying to bring up our switchboard.
Right.
Because we've got a lot of show to do tonight. What's your name, caller?
Gia, and I'm, I found you guys on Twitter. I follow you on Twitter. I'm an old world girl on Twitter.
Oh,
great.
Great. Twitter works. Twitter actually has value. This is awesome.
That's our proof right there.
Yeah, right there. You really are. That's my first proof that Twitter works.
Oh, we're so glad, and thank you so much for having this show. It's great.
Oh, well, thank you for calling and listening. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gia.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, I'm trying to pull back up the switchboard here, and we can get on. Let's talk about what I was getting into in Mr. Newborn, which we very much appreciate him calling.
That was a complete shock. I was very happy to have him call. I had no idea that was in the pipeline even, so
yeah,
that was beautiful.
Some surprises up my sleeve tonight.
Okay, that's a big surprise.
This is a big deal. I mean, because this is really, like I said at the top of the show, the voice of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And he meant so much to so many. The casting. Let's talk about the first kind of point of influence that he had. His introduction of so many new talents. We mentioned Molly Ringwald, and the list just
Michael
goes
Hall. I mean,
on and on and on and on. Judd Nelson, Ali Sheedy.
Yeah, now, let me ask you this, though. Doing some research during the last couple of days, he did not want to work. He never worked with Judd Nelson again after Breakfast Club. There was, and he didn't even want to work with him during the movie, but that was, there were a lot of...
No, he did. Judd Nelson came in. He was late for his audition in the Breakfast Club.
Mm-hmm.
And automatically he started pounding into Anthony Michael Hall as the character.
Right.
And then he said, I got to go. And he walked out.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hughes said, well, he's perfect, isn't he? And Anthony Michael Hall said, yeah, let's go with him.
He
showed up like an hour late and left after 5 minutes. But he made such an impression they knew it was him.
Yeah. But what about after that? Is that true, though, that these things?
I have no idea. I mean,
I didn't know about this until, like, the other night, so I had no idea. So.
Yeah, I know that Judd Nelson released a statement, and he's very grateful and influential, grateful for the influence that John Hughes had on his life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, without
a doubt. Terrific performance in The Breakfast Club.
Oh, those five performances in there, I got to be the last time, you know, the most recent Friday night watching this. God, Ali Sheedy was so cool in that film. And she's so cool in everything that she's done recently. But, God, she's so funny in that. Her timing and everything is just perfect.
Yeah. Can you do me a favor? Can you try to patch into our switchboard for me? Well, I'm still trying to patch this back in.
Okay, yeah. Let me give you. You got to give me a second here, though. But yeah,
okay.
I'm more than happy to do that.
Because this interview that we're going to get to now, this is with a terrific talent in her own right. She's a really kind of legendary casting director. Her name is Jackie Birch, and she has she cast John Hughes' first three movies, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, and Weird Science. So really, her influence is extraordinary because she formulated what became known as the Brat Pack. You know, there's an argument whether or not that's just a dismissive term for that group of actors. But there's something special about finding individual talents, first of all, but then finding talents that meld so well together. You know, the chemistry between all of these kids was amazing. And she did that. And so she was tremendously influential in John Hughes' career and vice versa. And she had a great number of great things to say about Mr. Hughes. Do you have it up by chance?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
So I've got to continue my...
Yeah, you got to continue.
Who did you out of those kids, who did you most identify with?
Who did I most identify with at the time I watched it? I watched this on... The first time I watched this film was on videotape. I would honestly have to say that the Anthony Michael Hall character, although I wanted to identify with the Judd Nelson, that was not in the stars.
I think I was the same way. My switchboard is back up, so let's play this.
Okay, you got it. Thank God, because this was going to get embarrassing.
I got it, baby. I got
okay.
it. So here is Jackie Birch. A great conversation we had with her about the legacy of John Hughes. Enjoy. So you first worked with him, 16 Candles. And that was something like your third movie and his first as a director.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys were both pretty new. I'm wondering what your impressions of him were right out of the gate on that project.
Oh, it was great because this was a time when you could cast for just the right casting and you didn't have to have, you know, this star meter kind of actor for foreign and all that. So we just worked so well together. John and I were on the same page from day one, and I had known him when I was like an associate on another movie that he had written a script. So when he came to Universal, the first thing he said is, I want Jackie to do it.
Wow.
And we just clicked. It's just, we started in L.A., we went to New York, we got it cast fairly quickly, and just never, ever had, you know, we just agreed a lot. And he gave me complete freedom to do what I want to do, which is the way I like to work.
Well, tell me about his. Tell me why you think the two of you clicked. Tell me a little bit about who John Hughes was as a colleague and as a friend.
When John Hughes started, he was this Midwestern sweet guy that just was, you know, open, brilliant with music, knew how to pick, you know, the soundtracks, you know, just a very intelligent guy, and the scripts were fabulous. So to start with 16 Candles, you know, it was so realistic. And since then, I've named my daughter Sam.
Oh, wow.
But I also did that off of the Bewitch, but it was funny that she was Sam in that.
Yeah.
He was just very open and just fun. We just had a great time on 16 Candles.
Yeah. And in terms of his writing, because he was a very prolific writer and, as I understand it, a very fast writer, too.
Yes, very fast.
When you read a 16 Candles or a Breakfast Club, what were your impressions of those scripts and what was his unique voice? How would you describe it?
I would say his unique voice is he was so realistic about kids. It's like every kid could relate to what the girl Sam was going through. And Breakfast Club had a whole other level, which is high school, which is a tough time in kids' life.
Mm-hmm.
And he just had the voice, and no one has matched him since. No one has made kids as realistic and you know, really showing what they go through since John. I mean, John, in Breakfast Club, you knew you were reading something. You know, it had a lot more depth than, say, 16 Candles, but 16 Candles had its own charm.
Mm-hmm. So, but did they feel like they could be as influential as they became, these kind of watershed projects?
I think until you saw it alive, I mean, there were so many things that fell into place on Breakfast Club. The casting, the Dee Dee Allen doing that, Annie Leibovitz doing the picture. It was like everything kind of fell in, and John you know, he did a great job on 16 Candles. And so then Breakfast Club, he was, you know, even more experienced. And it just, you know, paid off. And he had Nick Cannon as a producer who was so supportive. And, you know, and 16 Candles, like, we all were in agreement. Like, we, it was interesting, the casting process, how Getty came in to me and he pretended he didn't speak English. I found the girl, Beth, who played his girlfriend way out in New Jersey, because I went to a play to see that and found her. So it's very interesting how it all fell into place.
Well,
Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah, that's just it, because one of the big influences he had on the industry, obviously with your assistance, is he introduced so many new talents to film, to the medium.
Yeah.
You both were so tremendously perceptive and influential in your eye for new talent. And I'm curious, your conversations with him about what he was looking for, what kind of directions did he give you?
He didn't really. John let me just go, and that's the way I work. I'm someone who likes to see everybody, and I scour the talent. And, I mean, I found that one kid who played the geek in a movie theater. He really wasn't an actor. But
wow.
He was, you've never seen a face more geek, you know what I mean? And he always thanks me for paying for his college education. Wish someone would have done that for my kids. Yeah. But, you know, he just let me have that kind of freedom. He didn't tell me, you know, we just went forward, you know. He wrote it for Molly, so we knew we had Molly. And I found a lot of the cast in New York, Blanche Baker and Michael Schoefling. And, you know, and I fight for my actors. Like Michael Schoefling, they thought was a little, you know, quiet. And I said, oh, he was at the dentist. He's just low-key because of that. But he was really shy. And he was a model. And it wasn't like he was used to this whole process. But I knew he had it in him. And he also was a different look than what you would think, that the way they always cast those pretty boys. He was really interesting looking.
Yeah. Was he looking for something like, was he looking for not the obvious in the talent that you guys chose?
I don't really remember ever having those discussions. I just started casting and just started bringing in people. And it's kind of how I've always worked. I've always given enough variety that, you know, unless someone says it has to be a black person, I've always just gone out and tried to do different things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, 16 Candles was, and it's funny because I didn't have kids then, but it was just that I just found it very easy to relate to each one of the characters, and I loved doing the grandparents because everyone and their mother came in for that. But we didn't have to have, like, a big star. You know, we could go with Carol Cook and Billy Bird and people and Paul Dooley. It wasn't like you had to have, you know, the way they cast today for foreign markets.
Yeah. When you observed him, as I would imagine you did, working with actors.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, he was just so easy and down to earth, and everybody liked working with him, and he just knew how to relate to kids. Like, if you had seen Anthony Michael Hall when he came in for his reading, he was against Eric Gurry, and that was the hot kid at the time. Eric Gurry, he had done the Al Pacino movie. He came in and he was real, like, out there and, you know, so obviously funny. And Michael Hall was very shy, and I kept saying, no, it's Michael. There's something about Michael. Well, there was magic between John and Michael. It's like when those two, I don't know if they were like, you know, alter egos of each other, because when they got to work on the set, you saw the real Michael. You didn't see it necessarily in the reading, but, you know, John had known him from one of the Lampoon movies, but it wasn't 100% guaranteed that it was going to be Michael. But then when they finally came around, because I kept saying, he's quiet, he's shy, he's got that sweetness, it's not so out there, you know? Anyway, they went with him, and it was history after that, but it was a lot what developed between John and Michael.
This is a mother... It's a Rolls Royce, Jake.
So?
So... I heard the grill won't cost $5,000 this. $5,000? Do you have $5,000? I don't have $5,000.
Then don't hit anything.
Oh, don't hit anything.
He's magical in those movies, Anthony Michael Hall. Just
that was him and John. It was their relationship. It was just, it just, you know, brought out the best in both of them.
Well, I think this is of someone like Spielberg, too. There seems to be a part of them that is so in tune with their inner child. Would that be true of John, too, would you say?
Yeah, and I think John probably, when he was younger, probably was the geeky kid. So I think he could relate. You know, I think he came from a place where he understood these kids. And first of all, I am so sorry about this. This is so sad to me, and I feel so bad for his wife and his kids, who now have kids. See, when I knew them, they were little kids.
When I read about his life after his passing, that was something that was particularly moving to me. He was married to his high school sweetheart for 39 years, and
yeah.
It's, yeah.
And he's in a farm, which I didn't even know that. See, I knew he was kind of he became like a recluse, is what everyone kept saying. That
right.
He just stayed in Chicago, and I guess he penned some scripts under a different name, but you know, he really didn't seem to want to be in the movie business anymore, which is heartbreaking because he had a voice that no one has matched. I don't think there's ever been a kid movie that's been anywhere near what Breakfast Club was.
And kids watch that movie today, and they still get it. They're still engaged by it. And obviously, when I was a teenager, which was during the period of time when he made movies, I can go back and watch those movies and be very involved and invested in them as well.
People, I think, really, like, sometimes they'll come up to me and they'll pretend they're bowing because I think it struck such a chord in kids that you know, if they were hurting, I don't think they were hurting as much after the Breakfast Club, because I think they saw that this is what other kids go through, and I don't think anyone had ever done that really before. So I think it was good all around.
PB&J with the crusts cut off. Well, Brian, this is a very nutritious lunch. All the food groups are represented. Did your mom marry Mr. Rogers?
No, Mr. Johnson.
Huh. Here's my impression of life at Big Bri's house. Son? Yeah, Dad? How's your day, pal? Great, Dad. How's yours? Super. Say, son, how'd you like to go fishing this weekend? Great, Dad. But I've got homework to do. That's all right, son. You can do it on the boat. Gee. Dear, isn't our son swell? Yes, dear. Isn't life swell?
Do you think the teen movies now, or the depictions of teens, how are they different from when John Hughes made movies about them? He would have
so superficial, and they're so cheap that they don't give teenagers enough credit. And I think where Breakfast Club worked is that it was a much more intelligent kind of movie, and I just don't think people have done that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, and I think with Molly, it's that, you know, the 16 candles, the first crush, the girl, not the pretty girl to get a boy like that. And I think it just struck a chord with people so that kids could relate to that, you know?
Yeah.
And nowadays it's always it's tits and ass, or it's the prettiest with the prettiest, and it just, it doesn't have the depth. And John was great with adding music, too. His music choices were amazing.
He was. Yeah, that was
yeah.
another great point of influence that he had. Just terrific instincts.
Yeah.
And since this was so early in both of your careers, and obviously you're extremely successful in what you do, and you've done so many terrific movies, how did your experience with him influence you, and what did you learn from that?
Well, you know, it's a rare treat when you get a director who absolutely treats you like a comrade. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where he listens to what you have to say. He and you kind of like are on the same wavelength. He wasn't worried about anything as far as, you know, oh, that's not a big enough name or this. He was just very, he went for talent. He appreciated talent, you know. And so, you know, you have those experiences with other people and some you don't. And John, you know, John did his homework. So it was good. He was very, very open guy. And it's just sad.
Yeah, it's a loss. It's a terrific
loss.
Yeah,
very young, just so young. I mean, even Weird Science, as you know,
yeah,
different as that was a fun movie because it was giving the boys and the geeks the time of their life to get back, to have some power. They
yeah
all get power later on when they grow up. But in high school, it's a very painful time most of the time for the kids that are really smart.
I thought movies like Weird Science and Ferris Bueller, I remember watching those films when they came out. I thought they were
yeah
the coolest films ever made.
I know. That was
yeah
cool. Because you know why? Ferris Bueller worked so well, too, because the kid was intelligent. He was
mm-hmm
smart enough to, like, fool the system, but not in a bad way. Not, you know what I mean? Not where he was hurting anyone, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, so that was fun. And, you know, John was good at that.
I'm not sure how old your children are, but has Mr. Hughes's movies meant something in their lives to them?
Yeah, this is what it meant to them. I got an autograph of The Breakfast Club. I have the original one, and I signed it thinking that that would mean they go, Mom, you ruined it now. You wanted to sell it because I put my name on it. So that's, you know, but they do. They love the movies, and I know they're proud when they tell their friends and stuff, so it's nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Birch, for spending time with us today. And
oh, thank
I hope
you.
To,
my pleasure.
I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, call me anytime. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, that's Jackie Birch, casting director for 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and Weird Science and other films in her career, like Die Hard and just some massive films on her resume. And those,
that is some massive films right there. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And those three with John Hughes were meant a lot to the culture at that time.
Oh, they still mean a lot. I mean, I'd like to add something to you to what she said. There are some films, I think there are two filmmakers, maybe three filmmakers, who I think did learn the right things from John Hughes. Obviously, the first is Kevin Smith, who said, I make John Hughes films with raunchy dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very accurate. I think Wes Anderson, who is definitely inspired by him, I see that. I think Greg Motola of Adventureland and
yeah
Adventureland and even Superbad, or The Day Trippers, I see the influence there. The one person that everyone says that is like the John Hughes of today, I don't see with the films he's directed. I don't see with Judd Apatow. I see with some of the films he's produced.
Right.
But not so much the ones he's directed. I don't see it.
Yeah, and there's a real turn towards raunch now with teen movies,
mm-hmm,
as Jackie was saying. It's missing the innocence, and I'm curious if you made a Breakfast Club today, if John Hughes were making movies today, if people would buy them, because they do have this innocence to them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I'm inclined to say that they would, because
I think
they're the handling of these characters are universal, you know, and we can all relate to them. That hasn't changed.
Yeah, that's very true. I think the only film I can point to before 16 Candles that really spoke to my generation and your generation, and it is a raunchy film, is Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That was the
yeah
only film that really came
and
that, out
that's some that's somebody else. If we're
yeah
talking about people that have picked up the John Hughes mantle, I think Amy Heckerling deserves
Amy
to be
Heckerling
on that.
And Cameron Crowe, who wrote the script to that.
You even look at a movie like Loser.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you
oh
see,
yeah, good kudos for bringing that up. An underrated film.
Thank you.
I mean, dude, totally. That was a good film. People wrote that off as soon as it came out, and that was actually a good film.
Yeah, but we're talking about his music too. We mentioned
mm-hmm
that earlier, and Jackie mentioned it too. The next film we're going to be discussing is Pretty in Pink,
mm-hmm,
with director Howard Deutsch, and who also directed Some Kind of Wonderful
mm-hmm
and The Great Outdoors for John Hughes.
Right.
Here's probably, I would imagine, the most popular song to come out of that film. Are you ready for a little flashback?
I'm, God, all flashbacks the last couple of days. Go for it.
Here we go, man. If You Leave by OMD from Pretty in Pink. We have a caller. Let's take this caller real quick, and then we'll get to Mr. Deutsch's interview. It's a 708 area code. You're on the line.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Listen, I'm sure you know me. I'm I have a show on here as well. I'm called OSLCX, Old School Losers Club Radio.
Yes.
Yeah, we know you. We know who you are. You always listen to us. We appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you guys are doing this tribute to John Hughes, because my sister, including me, if anybody grew up on John Hughes, it's mostly us and my sister, because she would watch The Breakfast Club, and after that she would pop the tape in and Weird Science, and we had blasts. And I remember Ferris Bueller Day Off would come on summer 1991 on cable every day.
I remember that.
Absolutely. And I mean, John Hughes, to me, he was like George Lucas of the teen genre. He opened the door for teenagers in a way.
Yeah. And he can write better too, that's for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, and I believe and he kind of opened the doors for kind of like teen popularity in movies and TV now, like with 90210 and One Tree Hill, especially in the late 90s. In the late 90s, the teen genre was kind of making a comeback with like guys like even Kevin Williamson. He was like the John Hughes of his time at that time.
I can see that. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah, because...
And you know the thing about him is, about John Hughes, and this happens with any artist who's worth his weight and who leaves a lasting impression, he inspired a lot of crappy imitations because they went for the surface, but they didn't get the depth of what he had and what
That's
he brought
true.
To his films. And you see that time and time again with any movie that you know, really strikes a chord with the culture. But what's your name, dude? I know
my
your show name.
yeah, my name. You can call me Ike. You can call me Ike.
Ike.
Pleasure to talk to you.
I appreciate you listening as often as you do, and I appreciate you calling in. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show. We're going to get into Ferris Bueller in just a little bit. It's going to be great fun.
Okay.
Thank you so much, pal.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Once again, my switchboard went out, but it's coming
okay.
back up right now. Our next interview tonight, Howard Deutsch. He started out with John Hughes. His first films, Pretty in Pink, Some Kind of Wonderful, The Great Outdoors. Another artist that worked closely with Mr. Hughes and had an exceptional career as a result. And this is Howard Deutsch talking about his meeting John Hughes and the collaborations that they shared.
How are you doing?
Why haven't you called me?
Oh, I got nailed for the stable thing. I guess the groom's horse is against club rules.
I called you three times and I left messages.
Yeah? Well, I didn't get them. My family, they're very responsible about that stuff, you know?
I waited for you this morning.
Yeah, where?
Parking lot. I saw you, and I thought that you saw me.
No.
What about prom, Blaine?
Oh, man, I'm having a bad day. Can we talk later?
No. What about prom?
Come on, why don't we just meet after school?
No! What about prom?
Andy, come on.
Just say it.
What?
Just say it. I want to hear you say it.
Please, all right?
I want to hear you say it.
A month ago, I asked somebody else and I forgot.
You're a liar! You're a filthy fucking dober liar! You have a guts to tell me the truth! Just say it!
I'm not lying.
Tell me!
What?
Tell me!
What do you want to hear?
Just tell me!
What?
You're ashamed to be seen with
no,
me.
No, I am
You're
not.
You're ashamed
I
to go out with me. You're afraid! No, you're terrified your goddamn rich friends want to prove!
You don't understand it. It has nothing at all to do with you. Andy!
Your collaboration with John Hughes, it started, well, at the very beginning of your directing career. I'm wondering how that came about.
What happened was John met me because I used to make movie trailers, and I had done the trailer for 16 Candles.
Hmm.
And we met that way. And then Ned Cannon, who was at that time running Paramount Pictures, wanted to have a music video done for 16 Candles, and they asked me to direct it. So I directed it. I was going to hang up the phone with an artist named Annie Golden, and they liked it. And between that and my relationship with John, having done 16 Candles trailer and then working on the Breakfast Club trailer, and our kind of connecting just on the level of two guys liking each other, was kind of the beginning of a relationship, and that's how we got to do Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, and speaking of how you connected in terms of similar interests and personalities, tell me about his personality. What was he like?
Well, you know, when I honestly, he and I kind of connected. I think he liked the idea that I was not a film school guy. I was somebody who, like himself, started in advertising and learned kind of on the job and on the streets. And mm-hmm. so he was he liked, you know, people. He liked the heartland, Middle America. That's where he got his ideas about what kind of movies people wanted to see. And that's why I think ultimately he left Hollywood, because he felt like it wasn't really feeding him creatively. It wasn't representative of the way most of America lived and what most of America wanted to see in when they went to a movie.
Yeah, yeah. And what kind of presence was he as a producer of these films and as a writer? Was he on the set a lot with you on these projects?
Well, on Pretty in Pink, his presence was there at all times. It wasn't that he was on the set all the time. He was it was the first movie he produced. So, and he did have a strong entrepreneurial side, John, which most people didn't really know. And he had a big vision about that, and he wanted to produce a lot of movies. And this was the first. So he was really hands-on in the sense that he was aware of everything. And at the same time, not overwhelming in terms of intimidation. He supported me at every step of the way as a producer, not just a writer. And so I felt I was really blessed and fortunate to have him give me my break and give me that movie, because, you know, I was protected the whole way.
Yeah. Tell me about his writing, because he was very prolific. My understanding is he loved writing, and he wrote very fast.
Yeah, he was the fastest writer I've ever seen, or before or since. And just as an anecdote, I mean, one night he was writing something. We were supposed to do rewrites on a movie we did called Some Kind of Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And we started like at 11 at night in his office, and there was a couch in his office, and I would many times just fall asleep because he would write late into the night and the early morning. And I fell asleep as usual, and about 5 in the morning I woke up, and he handed me 50 pages. And I was like, "What?" I said, "What are you, that, we were supposed to do 3 pages of rewrites, that's 50 pages. He goes, "Oh, yeah, I didn't get to our stuff. I just wrote this, and I'm curious what you think. You know, I don't even know what it's about, but what do you think?" And it was the first half of Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Wow. I remember hearing that Steve Martin, I think, recently said that he asked John Hughes how long it took him to write Planes, Trains, and he said a weekend. It's unimaginable.
It is, and it was not an exaggeration. He let it gestate. I think, you know, my observation was for quite a while he previewed his ideas to people, you know, not even telling them it was a movie, just discussing, you know, a story idea. People not realizing it was being framed as a theme for a movie.
Yeah.
And then he would, I think, I'd preview that way and see how people reacted and bounce it off of them. But that was kind of the gestation period. And then once he sat down to write, it was just fully, just came.
Yeah, fully realized, fully there. Mm-hmm. Tell me about his characters, because I think that the trap that a lot of teen movies run into is that they're very shallow, and he had an understanding of teenagers, and he didn't, I guess there were types, because when you look at something like The Breakfast Club, you have the types, the jock and all of that, but through the course of the film, those characters transcend the types. Did you find that was the case with his writing?
For me, the characters that he wrote were slivers and slices of himself, and so it was no manufacturing process. It was a sense of humanity, real people, and they were related to by audiences, I think, because of that. People said, hey, that's like my uncle, or that I know that person, because, mm-hmm. you know, the behavior had a sense of truth to it that only could be done if it was coming from a reality. So, yeah, you know, I think that there are types of characters, but totally, in my opinion, I agree, they transcended those types and were fully realized and 360 degrees, you know, all around human beings all the time.
Yeah. Did you keep in touch with them through the years?
Yep, we did, and not so much recently, but over the years, yeah. And he was really glad to not be in Hollywood. He didn't like it there, and he had a farm, and he loved his farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I already miss him. I think he's an amazing giant, you know, in the film business, and the world will miss that, you know. But I had a friend and a mentor, so
yeah.
You know, I've lost that.
Tell me what kind of things, because these were the first three feature film films that you directed in collaboration with John Hughes, if I'm not mistaken. Tell me what you learned from him, what you took from him.
That's a good question. I mean, what I think I learned most was that he gave me the confidence, and he challenged me creatively to make choices that were kind of daring and that were more bold than I would have necessarily made on my own, and that had a humanity to them. And so that's what I learned, to take my time as a director and capture the behavior that was such a hallmark of all the work that he did. That's probably one of the biggest lessons he gave me.
I don't think I'm being weird, but what if she wants you to kiss her?
Well, then I guess I'm just going to have to kiss her.
Amanda Jones is no minor leaguer who will be swept off her feet at the touch of your amateur lips.
Thanks.
This babe has plenty of battle scars.
I think I can handle it.
Great. Well, I just think maybe you should consider whether or not you feel you can deliver kiss to kill.
You think I can?
If you say you can, you probably can.
Well, no, I'm no expert.
It's cool. I was just going to work on it with you, but if you're comfortable, great.
Wait. How do you work on it?
Pretend I'm a girl, okay? I mean, pretend I'm her, Amanda. I know it's a big stretch, but try it. Come here. I didn't mean to scare you. All right. What do you do with your hands?
Well, it depends.
No, it doesn't depend. They go on her head.
Okay.
Do it. Look into my eyes. Come on, I don't have to do this.
I know, I'm sorry.
Just grow up a little. So probably do this.
How do you know?
I watch a lot of TV. Close your eyes.
Some Kind of Wonderful. That was Howard Deutsch, director of Some Kind of Wonderful and Pretty in Pink and The Great Outdoors.
All fine films. I like The Great Outdoors a lot, too. I remember seeing that this summer that came out in the theater. That was a lot of fun. But that was a really good interview, Jamie. Very good.
Thank
I like
you.
It. Cause, I mean, no,
Thank
because
you.
I mean, we're interviewing these people, and I imagine a lot of these people, a lot of other people are making the rounds, and it's, I still haven't taken this in, really, so it's hard.
Yeah, and it really is a revisit to your childhood and these movies that made such a mark on you when you think back on John Hughes. And perhaps no movie of his in his resume made as deep a mark on me as this one right here that we're going to be talking about now.
Adam Lee?
Here.
Adamowski? Adamson?
Here.
Adler?
Here.
Anderson? Anderson?
Here.
Bueller? 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 Bueller?
I love it.
He's sick. My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
Thank you, Simone.
No problem whatsoever.
Fry. Fry.
Wow. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which we just heard from Mr. Deutsch. He wrote the first half of in 6 hours.
That's incredible.
I know. It's amazing, amazing stuff. I remember just falling in love with Ferris Bueller. I mean, this was
wonderful.
The ultimate teen character.
Yeah.
You wanted to be him, absolutely.
Everyone wanted to be him in high school. Even in college, we still wanted to be him.
Yeah, and we couldn't couldn't arrange an interview with Alan Ruck. We're trying, who, of course, so indelibly portrayed Cameron in
That's right.
Ferris Bueller. When Cameron was in Egypt land. But he did write us an email, and he wanted us to relay this message that... John gave me the best part I've ever had in a movie and the break of a lifetime. I will be forever grateful. Most teen comedies deal only with the frivolous aspects of adolescence, the self-centeredness, the preoccupation with sex, and so forth. John was special in that he saw teenagers as complete and complex people, full of contradictions, capable of foolish mistakes, but ultimately filled with hopes and dreams and wonder. Young people have lost a loving advocate. We all have lost an American original.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful, beautifully stated from Alan Ruck. And really just the most joyous film,
it is.
I think, on his resume. I mean, no more so than the parade scene.
Mm-hmm. That's a classic, iconic scene.
When he starts singing Twist and Shout and the marching band and everything, I mean, it's a moment of transcendence.
It is. It really is.
It's a great scene. And one of the great performances in Ferris Bueller, a movie that's filled with him, is from our next guest, Miss Edie McClurg. And she's been so memorable in so many of John Hughes' films. We also talk about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and her unforgettable scene in that film.
That's a great scene.
We'll play that unforgettable scene in a little bit. The uncensored. So we might, you know, if you have children around, prepare for that moment.
Send them to watch something else, Scooby-Doo or something.
This is a great conversation we had with her about her feelings about John Hughes and their work together. Edie McClurg. I'm curious to know about your first meeting with John Hughes, if you recall it.
As a matter of fact, it's chronicled in the book called A Star Is Found, written by Janet Hershenson and Jane Jenkins. They are the casting directors for many of his films.
Mm.
I'll read you something, and then you'll
sure.
know.
Okay? All right.
Like most casting directors, Jane and I have our favorites among working actors, people who we think have interesting faces, big talents, and a gift for making the most of the small but juicy parts. Edie McClurg, for example, is the plump, pursed-lipped lady with the strong Midwestern accent, whom I first cast as Grace, the secretary, in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She was with the famous comedy troupe known as the Groundlings, and she used to perform her own trademark characters on David Letterman's daytime show. If you watch TV or gone to the movies during the past 3 decades, you've almost certainly seen her, probably several times. I picked her out immediately for Ferris Bueller because I knew that director John Hughes liked to populate his films with offbeat, distinctive characters. John never considered a small part a throwaway. No good director does. And he was always looking for someone who could contribute an unusual flavor or quirky line delivery. And I'd realized right away that with John, I'd need plenty of backups for every role. He likes to see a lot of people. But in Edie's case, I knew it wasn't necessary. Sure enough, as soon as she walked into the audition room, he began to smile. Oh, yeah, I thought, this was meant to be. Edie made even the tiniest role sing, and from then on, whenever we were casting a movie, John would say, okay, here's the Edie part. Or, wait a minute, how are we going to use Edie? So that was high praise indeed. And I did actually 5 films with John, and 1 film before Ferris Bueller's Day Off was Mr. Mom, which he wrote, but he didn't have a track record as a director, so they didn't let him direct that. But then that was 83, and then in 86 he did Ferris Bueller and went on to direct.
Wow. So what were your impressions of John Hughes during your creative collaborations?
Well, what I really loved about him is that he was very quiet. He didn't yell or bully you. He would say, what do you think about this here? Could you be doing something here before we get to the written part? And, you know, I'd suggest something. And when we were going to do Ferris, at the time it was popular among young actresses, young women, to have long, straight hair. So for Mia Sara, who was playing the girlfriend, Sloan, she had this long, straight hair, so they hired her hairdresser to blow out her hair every morning, but he didn't know how to do any other kind of hair. Is the perfect foil for that, because he's very meticulous in his sartorial and his clothing. Mm-hmm. He's very, very clean and a little shy, is the Mr. Beautiful, gorgeous Steve Martin, and then there with John, it was just, you know, his shirt tail is always falling out of his pants, and you know, he's wearing big brogans and just a big presence. And then there's this tiny, slim guy by his side, and gets thrown into that. I can't think of a better pairing for a comedy film than those two guys, and John put them together.
I mean, those guys, I mean, they're classic, and it's a shame that John's no longer with us, because he was just a comic dynamo, a fireball, whenever he was on screen.
Now that you mention Planes, Trains, I have to know about your scene, because that is a highlight of that movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it again the other night, and I was just on the floor laughing at that scene. Was that difficult to get through? I would imagine it would be.
Well, you know, I was playing my servo mechanism, you know, person behind the desk, and when he walks up to me, I thought, just to give him a little more aggravation, I'd be on the phone, and, you know, and just putting up that one finger, which you just hate to see somebody
right.
do when you try to get something done, you know, just putting up that finger. And what I did is I just picked up the phone and was pretending to do a car transaction, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that for a couple of takes. And then John leaned forward from behind the camera and he said, this time talk about Thanksgiving. And I said, okay. So I just let fly with the monologue that it was even longer. And because I had some Catholic references in there that John didn't quite understand, which I thought were incredibly funny, but only Catholics would probably get it.
Mm-hmm.
So he cut that out, but I had added in that, you know, well, we, you know, Mama get up, you know, and get the turkey in, and we got to get miniature marshmallows for the ambrosia, And then I added, which he took out, we got to keep Uncle Billy away from the bourbon and ginger because he's going to start arguing the virgin birth with Father Ed. And so I finished off the monologue, and he said, okay, how do you do, because the writer in him was saying, how do you do that? I say talk about Thanksgiving. You give me a minute-long monologue. How do you do that? Because he was, like, picking my brain. And I said, I'm a cannibal. That's all about my family. It's all true.
It sounds like he gave you so much freedom, though, as an
actor.
Oh,
he did. Well, when I came in to do the what I did when I came in for the audition is the line, you know, the sportos, the bloods, the dweebies, the dickheads, they all adore him.
Mm-hmm.
He's very popular. That's the way the line ended on the audition scene. And I added, because I had the Chicago accent going, and so I added, they think he's a righteous dude, because I wanted to use the word dude with that accent. And John laughed, and he put it in the movie.
Wow. Oh,
great.
So funny. Looking back on his career, what do you think his legacy is?
Well, I think up to that point, most movies that had teenagers in them were all written by older people who've forgotten what it was like to be in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And John never forgot what it was like to be in high school. And among that whole list of the dweebies, the dickheads, all of that stuff, after we were, you know, we finished shooting and we were going to turn around and get the other direction with the camera. So we had a few minutes there. And I said, okay, so John, which one of you were in this list? Which one were you? And he looked at me and he said, Wastoid.
No wonder I loved him so much.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So he was that quiet guy observing everything in high school. You know.
Did you stay in touch with him at all through the years? Or?
You know, she's having a baby, which came out in '88, was actually shot before Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and Paramount didn't have very much faith in it, and it's actually John's real-life story of him and Nancy living in the suburbs and him going on the train into the city to do advertising and write advertising copy and shoot commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would come home and have dinner, and then he would go up and start writing in his little writing room, and that's where the first movies, Mr. Mom, came from, with him. And so that movie is a pretty true story, including, you know, the umbilical cord being wrapped around his first son, John's neck, and not knowing if the baby was going to make it or not. All of that was a true story.
Mm-hmm.
And they had called and said, we're going to have a wrap party. It's tonight. Come at about 11 o'clock. For a wrap party. So I showed up and there wasn't anyone there at the restaurant, and I said, what's going on? They said, well, they're trying to get the last scene finished, and they'll be over. And then they came over at midnight and they said, it's not going to happen. So we all just went home. And later I found out that they were doing that very sensitive scene, and the studio shut him down at midnight. They didn't want to pay the overtime.
Huh.
And it was not long after that that he moved back to Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he had made so much money for them with Ferris Bueller and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and then they wouldn't give him another hour.
No, they're such bottom line. Just ridiculous how cheap they are.
And a man that defined an era, but at the same time he made movies that we as adults can go back to and enjoy, and children of today can enjoy them too.
Every Thanksgiving, people screen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles at their house.
Yeah.
I know people
yeah.
who come up to me and they say, oh, every Thanksgiving or every Christmas, we have to have planes, trains, and automobiles. We just have to.
Absolutely.
It's a, mm-hmm. it's
of course.
It's a tradition in whole families. We
yeah.
all get together. And, or,
and he did this. He did the same thing with the Christmas vacation.
Yeah,
with production work.
Yeah.
yeah,
sure. And that somebody, this one guy, could resonate so broadly with so many people, and he was the most unassuming person. And he loved his wife and family. He met his wife in high school,
mm-hmm.
and they, you know, were a couple so much in love all their lives. And he loved his boys so much, and he saw what was happening. You know, they went to a privileged school, and they were around privileged children of privileged parents, and
mm-hmm.
he didn't like what he was seeing happen to them and their personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And being, you know, rich kids of a famous father, he couldn't stand that, and that's another reason that they moved back to
mm-hmm.
the Midwest. He didn't want them raised around that kind of, you're better just because you're my son. No.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's very mm-hmm. that was very sensible of him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great loss for all of us, and
it is.
Thank goodness we will always have those films, and they will survive forever, for as long
I mean,
as.
How many other you know trendy type of film do you see 25, 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
and it's still understood and it still resonates with the teenagers of today?
It's
how
still
could
got,
that happen?
Yeah. It's still got that universal appeal and that emotional resonance.
That's what it has. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And it was written by a guy who could remember what it felt like to be 14, 15, 16
mm-hmm.
years old. And it wasn't some old guy, you know, hacking out a script where he thinks kids talk this way. No.
Mm-hmm.
He had
mm-hmm.
his ear open all of his life, and he could bring
right.
it back at any point.
Yeah.
What an artist.
Yeah, very much so. Edie, thank you so much for calling in and participating. I hope we get to welcome you on in the future for a happier occasion. But
yes.
I appreciate your time so much.
Yes. Thank
okay,
you very
thank
much.
Thank you, boys. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Edie McClurg. So memorable in movies like Ferris Bueller and Planes, Trains.
She called us boys. That made me feel really good. I'm not joking, dude. That made me feel really good. She called us
yeah.
boys.
Yeah, and she did a little bit of a Ferris Bueller for us, which
yeah.
was great. Let's play her scene in Planes, Trains.
Let's do it. It's perfect.
Unfortunately, that very opening that she was talking about isn't part of this clip, but put the kitties in a different room if there are any out and about within hearing distance.
You're great. I love it. You're so concerned with children's ears. I love it.
Yeah, it's a new improved Jamie. But when we're talking about Apatow and the other teen movies of today, this was one of John Hughes' adult films.
And a successful adult film.
It's perfect,
yeah.
And this is as raunchy as he got,
mm-hmm.
Was this scene right here. The
That's
right. funniest scene from Planes, Trains.
Welcome to Marathon. May I help you?
Yes.
How may I help you?
You can start by wiping that fucking dumbass smile off your rosy fucking cheeks. Then you can give me a fucking automobile, a fucking Datsun, a fucking Toyota, a fucking Mustang, a fucking Buick, four fucking wheels and a seat.
I really don't care for the way you're speaking to me.
And I really don't care for the way your company left me in the middle of fucking nowhere with fucking keys to a fucking car that isn't fucking there. And I really didn't care to fucking walk down a fucking highway and across a fucking runway to get back here to have you smile at my fucking face. I want a fucking car right fucking now.
May I see your rental agreement?
I threw it away.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, what?
You're fucked.
Classic, dude. She has that's just so classic.
Oh, that is one of the all-time great comedy scenes. And of course, the other one that everyone knows who played Strains is the whole "those aren't pillows" scene. And
yeah, that was great.
Yeah, a great comedy pairing, the two of them. Just
mm-hmm.
wonderful. We actually spoke about John Hughes last year. It was prior to the summer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was.
I do remember
actually,
us talking about.
Might have been about 2007, and we were talking to the film commissioner of Chicago, and
we had a lot of questions about John for him.
Yeah, we talked about Dark Knight. We talked a little bit about Public Enemies, which was shooting at that time in Chicago, and we closed off with a conversation about John Hughes. And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about mention the Chicago connection with John Hughes. He was, you know, the very best term of the word, a regional filmmaker.
Yeah.
He loved the Chicago area. And we were kind of talking about his self-inflicted anonymity now, the later part of his life, and trying to find reasons behind that. And obviously the reasons now have come out.
They have.
Edie just talked about it a little bit, even though he did continue to write and produce some films. But here's Rich Moskal. He's the commissioner of film for Chicago, talking a little bit about John Hughes with us in 2007. Speaking of Chicago filmmaking heroes, and this is the last question. I'll let you off the hook. John Hughes.
Yeah.
Have you met him? Because he seems to be in hiding.
Yeah, I have met him. I've met him several times over the years. Actually, worked for him on one picture that he did here, Miracle on 34th Street. He produced it and wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John has, and I'm sure he doesn't need to work these mm-hmm. days from a financial standpoint. He stopped directing some years back. He's still very active writing. It seems that whenever word of him getting back into it starts to bubble up and things get close to happening, something goes awry and the picture falls apart or he drops out of it. Mm. You know, I don't know well enough, but he certainly has a reputation of being somewhat eccentric. A lot of people here locally have tried to reach out to him. Not that he's holed up like a John Hughes character someplace, but, you know, John, are you okay? I'm sure he's doing fine, but he probably doesn't need to work. And it seemed like he was championing his son's career more than his own there for a number of years. The last thing that he did here that I was aware of, he actually rewrote a script called The Visitors, which actually was a huge European box office success, and adapted
right.
for an American audience, which became Just Visiting.
I remember
yes.
that. Yeah.
Yes.
And man, the film tanked. It really did not do so well.
Kind of film as the French one, just with English. And,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I couldn't get over.
In fact, Jean Reno, it was a lot of the same actors.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
In fact, it was the same director. Hughes rewrote the script. I think he had maybe was going to be part producer, but I think his love affair with some of the politics of filmmaking is long gone. I think he feels like
right.
something he's just not interested in. And then the last thing, I think Made in Manhattan was a script that he wrote, which I believe he was going to direct. In fact, he was going to direct it here in Chicago. At the time, it was called Chambermaid, and then it was changed to Made in Manhattan, and then it was Made in Manhattan, or at least made to look like it was Made in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, John was he was a machine. He was cranking out movies that he was directing or producing or furthering the careers of people like Chris Columbus and the Home Alone
yeah.
series, he was like a one-man band, and frankly, while there were some other folks doing it at the time as well, directors like Andy Davis and Michael Mann, John was very much put Chicago's North Shore on everybody's map. I mean, it became like the place of an entire generation, and with the fascination people have for movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Breakfast Club and 16 mm-hmm. Candles, he really did Chicago a great service. And the fact that he's somewhat eccentric, I think, just makes it that much more interesting.
It does, doesn't it? He's like the J.D. Salinger of filmmaking.
Exactly.
No,
there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, there really is.
And for a guy like me in a show like this, I mean, he is. I mean, people ask me who's the brass ring, and I mean, my personal idol is Al Pacino, but really the brass ring is John Hughes because we haven't heard from him.
Right.
Our
office produces what is an outdoor film festival here in Chicago, which actually is a huge event. It draws like 30, sometimes almost 40,000 people out in Grant Park to watch.
That's incredible. That's
it
a
really
great
is.
Turnout.
And it shows American classics for the most part. And last year, I believe it was, or maybe it was the year before, we started, instead of just concentrating on movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s, we started moving up in the decades and actually showed Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And invited John to come and, do whatever he wanted to do. He could just hang out quietly and watch the movie.
Right.
Or he could say something or kind of left it open. I wrote what I thought was a rather impassioned letter in the hopes of getting him to come downtown, but to no avail,
mm-hmm.
which was cool.
Wow.
But I think... part of his attractiveness just seems to grow the less people know about him these days. And
I guess that's true. Yeah.
And he was never one, to my understanding anyway. He was never one to enjoy a lot of press or publicity.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't enjoy. Like I said, the sort of politics and the gymnastics of dealing with studio and budgets and things like that. I think he really just loved making films and telling his stories and working with actors. And obviously there's more to it than that. And I think after a while he probably felt like, I don't have to
do this.
It happens.
Rich Moskal, film commissioner in Chicago. He did respond to one person, and this is an interesting story that came out
mm-hmm.
upon his passing. A pen pal. He had a pen pal.
This is incredible. I didn't know about this till Friday. This is an incredible story.
Yeah, she wrote a blog about it. I'm not sure what she's doing now. She says in her little bio there, but she was very moved by the films of John Hughes as a teen, and she wrote John Hughes and
he wrote back.
Yeah, like Mr. Moskal said, a very impassioned letter. And she got this, standard routine pack, autograph photo kind of thing back. And she wrote back and said, I threw my heart out, and this is what you send me. And he wrote back a very personal message and said, I'm so sorry. I get so many letters, but let me tell you that your letter moved me. And
mm-hmm.
she wanted to become pen pals with him. And he said, sure. And throughout the years, they corresponded back and forth. And then one night he called her at work, I think. And they had an hour-long conversation, and he was very nurturing, very caring towards her. And it really is the most emotional tribute that there's been on the web since
mm-hmm.
his passing.
Right.
So I highly recommend you guys look that up. I know the link is on Movie City News, and Ain't
It's
Cool.
It's been all over the place
lately. It's a great story.
It's really a heartwarming story.
Yeah. Any last thoughts, Jared?
It's since this broke Thursday, this sad news, I've had a rush of flashbacks just from high school and beyond, and it's what we were talking about in that last interview, what happened to him. And when you find out the reasons, it's you have to give this guy props. He didn't want his kids to be poisoned by the whole Hollywood establishment, if you will. But also the other thing is he said, he told the pen pal they killed him.
And she was referring, and he was referring to John Candy. They worked him to death. And this is something I did not know. I did not know this at the time of John Candy's death, which was, you know, another one that went way too soon. He was doing a lot. They made it, you know, remember at this time, I think Canadian Bacon and Wagons East hadn't even come out yet. I don't know if I've ever sat through all of Wagons East, but it's, you know, he was really, really angry and heartbroken about his friend's passing.
Yeah, and that did come out, and that, but you know, his other reason for leaving the business, and he didn't completely leave the business. One time when someone said, "Why are you hiding out?" and he said, "I'm not hiding out, I'm just not living in Los Angeles." He still wrote. Yeah, he still wrote and that kind of thing. But his commitment to family, his marriage of 39 years, that's particularly moving to me. The fact that
it's commendable. It's beyond commendable. I mean,
he was a good man. And,
he was.
And you can see that in his films.
He was a righteous dude to the end.
No,
but that's really what...
That's perfect, yeah.
He really was. And, you know, it really just... I have it on my Netflix queue, and I haven't gotten around to it. I'm more than ever curious about Drill Bit Taylor now.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten a chance to watch it, but it's on the queue, and I'm just going to move it up. I really now want to see this.
Yeah, so this is an occasion to remember John Hughes. Go out, if you don't already own them. There's some great special edition DVDs of his films out. You can purchase some of them off of our page here tonight. So go out and review his legacy, and it's a legacy that will live forever. Jerry, thanks so much for this show.
Oh, thank you for getting it all together.
And, you know, John Hughes is gone. Is no longer with us, but his movies, they're not going anywhere. We will never forget his work. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a good night. We're closing out. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.